Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. St. Jose Maria Escriva, the founder of Opus Dei, wrote, God calls us through what happens during our day, through the suffering and happiness of the people we live with, through the human interests of our colleagues, and the things that make up our family life. This rather charming and inspirational description of the aims of Opus Dei seems entirely straightforward. But to the many listeners who've heard something about it as a movement, they'll know too, if only from the deeply untrustworthy populist novelist Dan Brown, that as a renewal movement, Opus Dei also has the capacity to stimulate great high-octane excitement and curiosity. Protestants are very wary of it, secularists are seriously suspicious of it, and even Catholics have raised some serious questions about it. Of the first two, both secularists and Protestants often misunderstand the currents of spiritual renewal that emerge regularly from within the Catholic Church in each generation. Protestants are suspicious in part because their opposition to Catholicism is predicated on an a priori assumption that their own movement had the effect of reconfiguring the Church to make it pure and more authentic. So it's emotionally very challenging for them to acknowledge that the Holy Spirit has been continuing a work that they lay exclusive claim to, and, following the evidence of history, doing rather better and more effectively than the mixed economy hydra-headed Protestant enterprise. Secularists find it difficult for a different reason, and it's partly because their primary assumption is that the Church must be engaged in a contrict of some kind. It must, they think, be masquerading as a spiritual agency, but really, once one lifts the covers of this deceit, be only interested in power, sex, and money. This perception is almost entirely due to the fact that since secularists themselves are often primarily interested in power, sex, and money, they can't imagine any more pressing or powerful motivation. They pay the rest of the world, and in particular the Catholic Church, the rather dubious compliment of making everyone else in their own image. The best recent example of these secularist suspicions will be Dan Brown's colourful but grotesque and gruesome misrepresentation of both the Catholic Church and, in particular, Opus Dei in the Da Vinci Code. For Dan Brown, Opus Dei could not be what it presented itself to the world as being, but instead had rather to be an exotic, secretive, controlling, masochistic and sexually repressive movement of sinister political ambition and power. But if all that misrepresentation wasn't bad enough, there's also been criticism from within the Catholic Church. Opus Dei has either suffered, as its friends would say, or provoked, as its critics would say, a range of exotic criticisms. No serious renewal movement is ever free from outrage and misunderstanding. But this podcast is not the place to attempt any public adjudication. For our purposes, Opus Dei has come to public attention this week because of the publication of a short motu proprio, which has had the effect of appearing to demote Opus Dei by placing it under the dicastery of the clergy and removing it from the congregation of bishops. For those not wholly familiar with the history, Opus Dei, formerly known as the Prelature of the Holy Cross and Opus Dei, in Latin Prelatura Sancta Crucis et Operis Dei, is an institution whose members seek personal Christian holiness and set out to colour and transform their work and that part of society affected by their work with Christian priorities and values. The majority of its members are lay people, the remainder are secular priests, under the governance of a prelate, elected by specific members and appointed by the Pope. It was founded in Spain in 1928 by the Catholic priest St. Jose Maria Escriva, and was given final approval in 1950 by Pope Pius XII. St. John Paul II made it a personal prelature in 1982 by the Apostolic Constitution Ut Sit. However, in the rather overheated atmosphere of political tea-leaf reading that inevitably accompanies the preoccupation with a balance or imbalance between traditionalists and progressives today, some commentators have seen this move into the dicastery of clergy and away from the congregation of bishops as a sign of yet one more restraint or slight delivered to a conservative movement. It might be that, or it might be an administrative adjustment that is wholly congruent with the charism of a humble grassroots, largely lay movement that invokes spiritual potency in preference to political power. Who better to inform us than Jack Valero, the head of communications for Opus Dei in the UK, commentating on the change and casting his eye across the contemporary Catholic landscape, including Pope Francis's apologies to the Indigenous peoples of Canada. Jack joins me now. Jack Valero, it's a great pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for taking the time and joining us. You're communications director for Opus Dei in the United Kingdom. So that means that everything that has gone right and gone wrong is all your fault because you've been in position for 20 years. So thank you for joining us. Opus Dei has been in the news recently because of a change in the way in which the Vatican is reorganizing its lines of accountability. But before we talk about that, and particularly before we talk about Dan Brown, I thought I'd ask how it was you came to be a member of Opus Dei in the first place. And perhaps for people who don't know, we have a number of would-be Catholics listening to this podcast, what the original vision for the renewal of the laity was that led to its creation.
Sure, thank you for having me. I met Opus Dei when I was very young because my father met Opus Dei first, and he came back and he joined very quickly after meeting Opus Dei. So I sort of knew about it. He didn't speak to me about it, but then in a school trip, I went to Rome and we managed to get into a meeting with Saint Jose Maria. It was just a few months before he died, and I was a typical schoolboy, and I was very taken by this figure of Saint Jose Maria, and listening to him, I can't remember what he said, but I was very moved, and that was the seed which later led me to seek more contact and eventually to join Opus Dei. Opus Dei's message is that everyone should be a saint. Everyone is called to holiness. All men and women are called to holiness in their ordinary lives, at work, at home, and that you don't need to be a bishop or a monk or a nun or something special to be a saint. Everyone in their married life, their ordinary secular life, is called to holiness, to the highest holiness. Opus Dei was started in Spain in the 1920s, but because of the civil war in Spain and the Second World War, it couldn't expand beyond Spain until the end of Second World War in 1945. And one of the early countries where it came to was Britain, because some people came at the end of 1946. We just celebrated the 75th anniversary. And in these 75 years, Opus Dei has been spreading through the country. And what we've done is just to show different people who have been helped by Opus Dei. We are making 3 or 4 minute videos that we are putting on our website, opusdei.uk, to show their lives, to tell how they came to faith and how they came to Opus Dei and how it helped them. In very, very briefly, different people, men and women, lay people, priests, in different professions, showing how it helped them and what their lives are like. So that's one thing. And Opus Dei, of course, became very famous in, let's say, 15 years ago with the Da Vinci Code and Dan Brown, which was, of course, complete rubbish. But the thing that it allowed us to do was to show ourselves as we were, as we hadn't been able to before, because maybe there wasn't so much interest in the country for religious things, for things to do with Catholicism and the church. But this allowed us to show ourselves and to explain who we were. And we feel that a lot of people came to know Opus Dei thanks to that. So in the end, we give thanks for that which was allowed by God, and we became much better known and able to follow our garrison more, you know, to give our message to many more people.
Well, it was the most amazing advertising campaign that any group could ask for, even though he quite clearly misportrayed you. It's interesting, though, how he misportrayed Opus Dei. It was all about purgation, wasn't it? And excessive purgation for the wrong reasons.
No, I think the Christian life is about prayer, sacrifice, and almsgiving. And, you know, if you take any of those to extremes, then something is not quite right. They teach ordinary people to bring God to their ordinary life by having deep prayer, a spirit of sacrifice and service to others, and an outward-looking, almsgiving spirit to help people in need. And it is in building up this integrity in people's lives that people come to approach holiness. Once you exaggerate one aspect, it can become completely the opposite of reality, you know. However, given that the book was rubbish and the whole tenet of the book, which was that the Catholic Church is a fraud, is quite rubbish. still gave us a lot of publicity that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And we used it, as I say, not to speak badly about the book because we didn't really care about it, but to be able to explain our spirit and our message much more to people.
And one of the great virtues of the organization is that you provide an opportunity for people to live in community, which seems to me to be particularly important at the moment with fractured families and a fractured society. And I'm not sure that the church has been particularly good at developing a sense of congregationalism in the sense that one of the things that happens if you're in competition with a different spirituality, so in this case with Protestantism, is Protestantism has majored on congregationalism. And perhaps it's no surprise, therefore, that Catholicism has celebrated the mystery and the power of the Mass, but without developing the dynamics of community so much. It seems to me that if you're going to renew the laity, offering people a new family, more balanced and personal opportunity to be part of a Eucharistic and praying community is really very important. Can you describe some of the communities you provide?
Well, in fact, it's not exactly that, but most members are married and live with their families. And, you know, let's say 20 to 25% are celibate. They find their vocation is to apostolic celibacy. And some of us live in centers of Opus Dei where we run the activities. And then, of course, we live family life. But most other people, as I say, the majority of the members live with their families. Opus Dei provides everyone, whether you live in a center or where you live with your family, which is the most common situation, with formation and support, guidance, spiritual guidance to seek God and to bring to God all the people around you in your family, at work and so on. So in that sense, it's very strong support. You know, it's not so much a close community where we go and have a good time because most people, as I say, are living their own lives, but it's a very strong support to bring God into your life so that you can be that witness at work, in your bank, in your university, in your trade union, or whatever, wherever it is you're working. And you know you are supported. People are praying for you. People are loving you. And you form a family with them, even though you are living your own life in your own home with your own family or alone if you are single or whatever. Think that when you're telling lay people that everyone's called to holiness, they do need a lot of help. You know, it's one thing to say it, but to make it happen, you need help in formation, support, sacramental help, and so on. We also, our members are generally very involved in their parish, and they go to Mass there and so on, and they help to make these communities that you mentioned as well, because being a Catholic also involves being part of a community. I think we've seen this, for example, with COVID, when people couldn't go to their parish to Mass. They stayed at home and watched it. And we lost something, you know. And it's only when people start coming back to Mass that we can rebuild these communities, because being a Catholic is not just getting the sacraments and praying. You have to be part of a community. You have to get to heaven with other people, you know. You can't get there on your own.
I think that's wonderful. That goes to the heart of it. There's always a danger, isn't it, that an emphasis on holiness. So everything has a vice and a virtue. There's an enormous virtue on being called to holiness. I guess the vice that one has to try and avoid is some sense of superiority or the finger wagging that's pointed towards people who pursue virtue. How do you manage to escape the danger of being seen to be superior or better than others whilst pursuing this enormously important call to virtue and holiness?
Yes, and I think that's an important point, because we need to speak from our vulnerability, really, and from our brokenness. And St. Jose Maria always spoke about the apostolate, the evangelization, as being through friendship and confidence, through friendship, you know, equal to equal, not from above. You go to church and the priest preaches and so on, you will learn. That's one way of communicating the faith that we get taught. But in the apostolate of lay people, it's about friendship. It's about sharing things from our vulnerability, as I said, because all of us are equally called to become holy. It's not that I'm speaking to you because I'm trying to be holy and I'm trying to convince you to try too. No, we're all equally called. and we're all equally helping each other to this destination. And so there is this danger you mentioned of speaking from above, but I think the whole spirit of Opus Dei and many of the other organizations that have lay people is this, that we speak to each other from our real lives, you know? So in particular, this Pope has been very good at saying, look, we need to be the peripheries too, the people who are suffering, the people who are alienated. And, you know, in most families of Catholics and most families of members of Opus Dei, there are many people who have fallen away, whose lifestyles are not in accord with what the Church teaches, and yet we are loving them. You know, it's only through our love that we're able to bring Christ to them, because they're not going to listen to us otherwise. So it's really the apostle of friendship, confidence, and love, and charity that is going to be able to spread the gospel. And in that sense, we can avert this danger that you mentioned.
I think it's a very beautiful way of describing it, because there is always this great difficulty that on the one hand, if you pursue holiness and obedience, and if you like what might be described as success, if there is such a thing in the spiritual life, it has the possibility of making other people who fail even more hopeless, even more marginalized. So I think, as you quite rightly say, the key to making holiness accessible is perhaps a shared sense of failure that all of us have sinned. It's the experience of forgiveness, I think, that is probably, and grace, that is the greatest driver towards holiness. And perhaps that's, in fact, the only route by which one can approach holiness, because anything else becomes meritocratic and over-muscular, and, of course, inevitably involves a sense of, look how well I'm doing. But it's a very difficult path to tread, to keep all the aspirations of obedience and purity whilst being authentic and honest about the degree of failure to it that one experiences.
Well, I think from the outside, it may look to some people saying, well, if you're trying, you must feel that you're better than others. But when actually trying it from the inside, you know that you're a failure. I love, for example, the letters of St. Francis Xavier to St. Ignatius Loyola. St. Francis Xavier, who became the man in the history of the Church who brought more people to the Church, more baptisms, more converts, etc. And he would write these letters saying, look, I'm a complete failure. Nobody's listening to me. I can't do anything. My life is a failure. And I think, wow, isn't that amazing that from the inside, this is what it looks like. From the outside, it looks completely different. So I think that people who strive for holiness, they realize that their life is broken, and that they're held together by grace, and that in that grace, they can also bring other people around in the shared brokenness, you know? So I think that even though the danger can be observed from the outside, once you're inside, once you are trying it, you realize it's not like that. It's very humbling. It's a very humbling life.
And what you've described in the life of St. Francis Xavier is found also, of course, in St. Paul in Romans 7, when he talks about the conflict between virtue and disobedience and the constant experience of failure. And therefore, where is the hope and mercy? Well, it's in our Lord's forgiveness. But is there a particular grace or virtue that not defines Opus Dei, but I mean, is, you've mentioned quite a number of characteristics, perhaps that's enough. But if people in the parishes were to think of Opus Dei, would they think of Dan Brown, or would they think of their neighbor in the pew? What would they, you know, for Franciscans, it's easy. We have St. Francis and even St. Benedict. We have the whole monastic ideal. What is the sort of single iconic representation of the aspiration of Opus Dei, if there is one?
Well, it's sanctification of ordinary life. Getting to God through your ordinary life with a deep sense of what we call divine filiation, that we're children of God. One of the most important sort of foundational graces that St. Jose Maria had, and one of the most mystical prayers he ever had in his life, happened on a tram. I think the Jesuits had just been, you know, expelled from Spain just before the Civil War, and that some apostolic projects that he had in hand were collapsing, and there was a lot of anti-clericalism in Madrid. And he bought the newspaper, and he was very upset and so on, and got into a bus. And then suddenly he had this inspiration to think, well, God is my father. God is my father. And he started saying, Abba, Pater, out loud. And he said, well, I better leave the bus because people think I'm mad. And then he spent an hour walking in the neighborhood saying, Abba Pata. And he remembered this as one of the most important moments of his life when he realized, I'm not going to do anything by myself. It's only because I'm a child of God. And therefore, everything is fine. Everything is fine because I'm a child of God. And I think that is at the heart of trying to seek holiness according to the spirit of Opus Dei.
The next time I go on a tram or a bus, I will invoke God in the same way. It's a very moving example of the ordinariness of our quest for spirituality. Let's move on to the politics of the church. One of the things I'm always impressed by is the way in which Opus Dei says it doesn't want to do church politics, and probably quite rightly, because it's the least attractive side of living in a family that has to be an organization. But the recent motu proprio on the figure of the prelate has changed the status of Opus Dei. It strikes me from what you've been saying that with the priorities and preferences that the movement has, this shouldn't matter in the slightest. Is that the way in which Opus Dei has taken this change? Because there are other people, of course, who see it as a demotion of a traditionalist organization. And given at the moment there's anxiety about the way in which traditionalism and whatever the opposite of it is, I can think of four or five names, given that the anxiety between traditionalism and non-traditionalism, people have taken different views on what this signifies. What's the view that you take?
Well, I don't want to look at this in terms of power or other worldly categories that don't apply, because this would be a distortion of the truth. The juridical path of Opus Dei was quite long, and when St. Jose Maria started, he had a charism of holiness in daily life, which would apply to men and women, lay people and priests in the world. And so he found that there was no juridical setting that would be applicable to what he was trying to do. And so he went through various stages trying to find the sort of juridical wrapping that would guarantee the secularity of the members and at the same time allow for some members to become priests to serve the rest, you know. So he was looking for these things, and then it became a secular institute. Then it became the first secular institute. Then secular institutes became more or less like religious orders. And he said, well, we're not consecrated religious, so that's not right for us. And eventually, the personal prelature figure was established by the Second Vatican Council, which guaranteed the secularity of the members. But the important thing here is the charism of Opus Dei, holiness in daily life through work and family, and the family spirit of Opus Dei, where the head of Opus Dei is called the Father, and we follow him. And so prelature for us was a way to say, well, here we are, lay people and priests working together in the secular world, and this works for us. However, in the Code of Canon Law, the prelature was defined as an organization for the distribution of priests for appropriate pastoral tasks, and that different prelatures would have different statutes that would determine how this was to be done. So there was also a tension there. You know, is this an organization like Opus Dei for lay people and priests working together, or is this an organization for priests which has lay people attached, which is not how we see it? So, and these two views have continued, and there's been a tension. Now it seems that this second view is more what was thought when Praedicate Evangelium came out in March, where it said, well, we're going to reorganize the Curia. And that's really important for the Holy See, because the Pope, before he was elected in the congregations, he was asked, look, whoever is elected, there needs to be a reform of the Curia so that it's more geared to its mission of sanctifying the world and less about politics and bureaucracy. And this reform has been going on until Praedicate Evangelium came out in March. Once it's come out, there are very many important things in Praedicate Evangelium, like the importance of the dicastery for evangelization, which is now at the top of the list, the new dicastery of charity, which says that the church engages in works of charity in a very important way. Now it's at that sort of level, etc. And many things. And one of the things was a personal preacher will report to the congregation for clergy instead of the congregation for bishops. That already came out in March. And when it came out, the prelates of Opus Dei said, well, filial obedience, you know, whatever the Holy See says, it's fine for us, we're going to follow it, we'll see how it pans out. And now in July, this thing, Praedicat Evangelium, is applied to Opus Dei through this motu proprio ad charisma tuendum. Like other things are being done, like women have been appointed to the dicastery for bishops, other decisions have been taken. This one is the one that applies Praedicat Evangelium to Opus Dei. And what it says is that the bull that set up Opus Dei as a person praetor now needs to be changed so that it no longer reports to the Congregation for Bishops, but to the Congregation for the Clergy. Okay, but it doesn't change anything of the charism of Opus Dei. And in fact, it reinforces the charism because it says, look, we must concentrate on the charism of sanctification in daily work, through work through family and so on, and lay people and priests working together. So it does emphasize that aspect, which is very good for us.
I see exactly what you mean. The key is, as you say, it reinforces the charism, because one of the great dangers in any renewal organization is the lure of power, status, and institutionalism. And if what is happening is that the organization is being saved from a degree of over-identification with the hierarchical structures, something with a group with the charism of Opus Dei could only be grateful. As you say, it's entirely appropriate with the spirituality that represents what everyone is pursuing.
And that's the important thing for us, you know. I mean, then it says, well, in order to achieve this, because it reports to the Congregation for the Clergy, the prelate will be a priest, monsignor, instead of a bishop. And before it could be a bishop, didn't need to be, but could be. But now we're going to just leave it as monsignor. And that's fine, because in fact, the founder was a priest all his life, and his successor, Blessed Álvaro del Portillo, was a priest all his life until the very end. He didn't really want to be a bishop, but John Paul II convinced him. And toward the last 3 years of his life, he was a bishop. So we have a lot of, Opus Dei, when it was founded and it was run for many, many years with a priest at its head. For us, the important thing is that the head of Opus Dei is the father. He's a father for us. We're a family. The fact that he's a bishop or not a bishop is not relevant. One thing that kept coming back to my mind when I was reading this document, which is very short, is what St. Jose Maria said. Opus Dei is there to serve the church as the church wants to be served. And this kept coming back to mind, you know, if the church wants to be served this way, then we will serve the church this way, because this is what our vocation is, to serve the church as the church wants to be served. Our charism is to bring people to God through our ordinary secular lives, and we will do that within the church. Opus Dei makes no sense unless it is within the Catholic Church. And therefore, when the Holy See says this is how it's going to be organized, we of course obey joyfully, because we want to serve the church as the church wants to be served.
I think that's inspirational. And thank you for expressing it so beautifully. Can I take you to another area of controversy? So at the time of our recording, the Pope Francis has gone to Canada and he's making an apology for the abuse that took place within Catholic schools. I personally find myself feeling very hesitant about this, partly because I'm never entirely convinced that apologies by heads of institutions have the effect everyone wants them to have. I think apologies by people who have caused harm to the people they have caused harm to are absolutely essential. But the moment you do it in a representative way, it begins to take some of the force out of it. And in this particular context, the damage done to the indigenous communities was caused by the Canadian government, who pursued a policy of assimilation. And it just so happened that the people who were providing the education as a matter of charity were both Catholics and some Protestants, and they were required by the government to follow government policies. It's also true, of course, that in all institutions, there's a degree of abuse. And there was abuse there. But I think the difficulty I have is that we don't seem to have an agreed capacity for making moral judgments. So there's this wonderful moment in Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar and the writing of the wall, he said, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And that seems to me a perfectly appropriate way of pursuing some kind of ethical judgment. But the weighing in the balances requires looking at both sides of the coin. And one of the things that the Catholic Church did through its evangelism was to offer sacrificially and with great goodness opportunities for education and health, and as well as evangelism. And in the context of the apology that secular society requires, there's no mention of any of the graces, the charisms, the sacrifice, the heroism of people who acted as missionaries. And if there was an articulation of both sides, a perfectly proper anxiety and repentance for abuse, but at the same time, a recognition of heroism and self-sacrifice, I think I would find it easier. But is it the fault of the media, do you think, that there is no sense of ethical or moral balance? Is the Pope required just by the fact that we have to speak in the language of the society we live in, which is all about victimhood and reparation? Or should the church be trying to help society find a different way of coming to ethical judgment?
I think in a simple way, I would say that people have suffered or have suffered over a long time, some of whom are still alive. The suffering was then, but the pain is still now. And yes, it was the government, but the church cooperated, unfortunately, for many years. The Pope said, I just read it earlier, you know, I ask forgiveness for the ways in which many members of the church cooperated in those projects of cultural destruction and assimilation stipulated by the government, which culminated in the system of residential schools. I think there are people who are suffering. And the way I see this Pope, and I think the previous popes too, because John Paul also went to Canada, and Benedict also apologized for the residential schools in 2009, is that there are people suffering, and we want to bring them to God. And therefore, we must suffer with them, apologize for any harm that has been done by Catholics or the Church, and accompany them in this place of suffering. I mean, it's very interesting that the Pope tends to go to places where people are suffering. And in this trip, he does go to big cities, you know, Edmonton and Quebec, but he also will go to Iqaluit, or however you pronounce it, and in a very remote place where he's going to be with them and where it signifies the suffering. When he went to the Philippines, he went to the place of the hurricane, you know, back then. And he didn't say very much. He just said, look, I'm here to suffer with you. I want to sit with you and cry with you. And I think that's what he's doing. The church suffers with you, even though we have been complicit in some ways. So, of course, there are many ways that this could be done. I personally think it's very moving what he's doing. He's not mobile. He's suffering himself. He's on a wheelchair. This trip has been very difficult for him. And yet he gets onto a plane and says, this is important. I need to go there and suffer with my children. I think that's very moving. And, you know, try to look at this and apply it to other areas of life, you know, that people have abandoned the church because they have felt rejected. Maybe we didn't intend to reject them, but in any case, they have felt rejected and they're no longer there. And I feel very motivated by this to go to these places, even though it may be a place of suffering, and suffer with people so that I can tell them, look, God is still with you. You know, and whatever has happened, we're in this together. I think that's really powerful.
Again, thank you for articulating it so well. The whole issue of theodicy, how you justify a good God in a world where there's so much pain, is at the heart of any attempt for evangelization, because it's a question that everyone has to find an answer to. And of course, the heart of the answer is found in the Passion on the cross. So you're saying, I suppose, that the Pope is acting almost as the prodigal father, running towards the people who are lost rather than waiting for them to come to him on his terms. And so that's enough.
And not only that, not telling them how good he's been to them, but just saying, look, you're welcome. You're welcome. Forget about it. You're just welcome.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. That's a very moving way of dealing with it. As you look at the next 20 years or so, having been responsible for everything for the last 20 years, how do you see the fortunes of Catholicism in its struggle to evangelize the world, and particularly in its struggle with the culture wars? Is the view from within Opus Dei one of hope and vigor still? Do you have an inspirational confidence for the future? How do you see the work of Opus Dei helping the church in what many people feel is a crisis of the coming decades?
You know, members of Opus Dei are right in society where things are happening, so they don't need to preach to it from the outside. They're sharing the difficulties of COVID. They're sharing the unemployment and disease and difficulties and the financial burdens of the cost of living, and they're sharing everything, and therefore they're speaking one, you know, equal to equal, and they have the same aspirations as the other people. And you know, one thing you find is that if you try to bring God to the world, there are many, many seeds of the gospel in the modern world, you know, the search for dignity, equality, the search for the truth, the care for the victim, the person who suffers. These are all very, very Christian values. You know, some of them have been twisted, but we share so much, and they're such Christian values, and people are doing many good things. And so when they hear of God, maybe they can tie it into the thing they've been wanting all the time. So I feel very positive. The church has contracted in Europe and has expanded in other parts of the world. So maybe history is saying something to us that things will happen. Opus Dei will come to its centenary in 6 years' time. We're preparing for this event by really thinking about people, you know, people's lives being changed by this message, and people being able to help other people one by one to find God and to find happiness and so on. And I think if you're in the middle of the world and you are developing with the world, well, you can see it. You're excited for all these developments, and these developments are also taking us to God, you know. So in that sense, we're optimistic.
Jack Valero, Head of Communications for Opus Dei in the UK, thank you so much for spending your time with us during this conversation, and for the wisdom and the compassion that you've brought to everything we've talked about. It's been lovely to meet you. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great to be here. Thanks.